Well, hello and welcome to the 1916 Company podcast. This is our inaugural edition. Tim Masso here with Armin Johnston.
Thanks for having me.
We are going to be talking about chronographs and the coolest watches that have passed our desk because we see thousands a year. We love to highlight whatever stands out, but this is a democracy, so if you have future episode ideas or questions you would like to hear answered in the future, reach out to us at podcasts@the1916company.com. Armand, what is the coolest watch that has passed your desk recently?
You know, it may not be my personal favorite, but it is one of the unequivocally coolest pieces. It is the H. Moser & C. Swiss Alp Final Edition, Final Upgrade, excuse me. And it is the Swiss Alp that looks the most like an Apple Watch.
Yeah, the crazy thing about it is those came out in 2016, and people did not get it. It was always supposed to be a send-up of the Apple Watch. It was always supposed to be tongue-in-cheek. It was never supposed to be in earnest. People get so hot under the collar, they're like, I know that looks like an Apple Watch. They copied them. Well, yes, they did. In the same sense as, you know, Mad Magazine copied the look of every politician ever. It was a joke.
And part of the fun for this is the fact that they took the running seconds and made it like the spinning wheel, the Apple spinning wheel. I you know, admittedly, a critique of this piece would be to double the timing of that spinning wheel. So it's a 30-second indicator rather than a 60-second indicator, because at this point it is a kitschy upgrade at best anyway. But I just love the little, I love that they took that design for it.
It's a lot of fun. I think it's one of those watches where you either love it or you hate it. There's really no middle ground. The look of the Apple Watch is clean and I think overall attractive even in this format. It is a black on black watch, black hands, black dial, black DLC case, super hard to read. You've got to be into kind of like the stark novelty of it. And I do agree with you that the update seconds hand is going to be probably the element that ages least well. I think the idea is one of those Swiss things that doesn't culturally translate.
I completely agree with you on that.
So fun watch, a 50-piece limited edition. That was 2021, and that was the end of the Swiss Alp watch. They generally did 50 a year. They did small runs from 2016 to 2021. So if you want a really rare Moser, and they are very rare by their own declaration, this is the one that's very, very rare.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong with this, but this is a watch that they started with the movement on, correct? They had 400 and some rectangular-shaped movements to fit in cases.
I believe they had them lying around. They call it the HMC 324. It's actually one of their premium pieces based on things like power reserve and the beat rate and the use of an overcoil. It's a very sophisticated movement, and it's actually case-back power reserve, so there's more to it when you turn it over. Very cool watch, but there's a lot of variants of the Swiss Alp out there, so find one you like and then go with that. This particular one is definitely for the guy who is into like the all black look. Who was famous for that in the past? Was like John Varvatos? Was that who?
Yeah.
This is like the John Varvatos Swiss Alp watch.
Now you see, probably admittedly, a few more watches than I do on a daily basis. What is your standout this week?
You know, it's funny because the first time I saw a Ludovic Baloir watch, it was at Dubai Watch Week in 2021. And we see everything. I've had two Philippe Dufour Simplicities cross my desk since then. This is the first Ludovic Baloir watch, and there's probably a reason for that. He's made a whole lot less than Philippe Dufour. Now, a little bit of background. He was born in the Brittany region of France. He took watchmaking school, got his certificate, went into aviation maintenance because there were no jobs for watchmakers in his area at the time, before moving to Europe, got a job as after-sales service on high complications with Franck Muller, went to work for F.P. Journe in 2001, stayed there for 7 years, struck out on his own, and in 2009 he launched his own watch, which was the Upside Down. Now, a really cool piece, a really nice guy. He's made anywhere from 12 to 24 years. The production is low. Every piece is effectively a piece unique. And he really does execute every part of this watch. Even the case back engraving is done by hand with a burin by the dude himself. So, first of all, really nice guy to know. So, if you want to buy the man before you buy the watch, this is a great example. The one I saw, as all of them, 41 millimeters with a sort of jumping time display, wherein the only hour that is right side up on the dial is the current hour. The idea is no time like the present sees the moment. But it is a 7-piece platinum aventurine glass dial version of the Upside Down that I saw. So this is limited even by his standards. And The aventurine glass dial was spectacular.
It was amazing.
Aventurine is so underutilized. I don't understand why it's not anywhere. Maybe we'll do a segment on like what the dial of 2024 is going to be now that the green trend is petering out. But I nominate aventurine.
You know, I hate to timestamp this show, but I was listening to your latest live show, Monday night live show, and you were discussing the movement on this piece, which I'm infatuated with this movement. The 12 Maltese cross construction is outrageous. It's incredible. I'm actually more interested that it's not an in-house movement and that it has a base to it that he honestly built upon. To me, obviously a different level of watchmaking of in-house movements, but it takes innovation. It takes interest. I'm interested when a watchmaker such as Ludovic makes something with a base movement.
Yeah, it's not uncommon for watchmakers, even at the highest level, to use basic trains. We've seen this from Raoul Pages. We've seen this from David Walter. We've seen this from Pascal Coyon and Garrick, and of course, Ludovic Balward. We've seen a lot of really high-end brands using the basic layout of an existing movement. That doesn't mean any parts are used, but once you start redesigning the train from the barrel down to the balance, that's really where watchmaking crosses over a line from craft knowledge that you could basically learn in an apprenticeship to engineering, where you have to have a formal background. That's why oftentimes you will see high-end watchmakers use the train from an established movement rather than building one their own. But with the Balward, it's a 35-millimeter movement, and you got to realize that the Peso 7001, on which the core is based, is only a 23.3-millimeter movement, plus the Ludovic version is 51 joules and the Peso is 17. So you wind up in a situation where, yeah, the geometry of the train is the same, but this is very much his own caliber, and I think it's just a testament to the fact that this really is cottage industry watchmaking, that he started with that, elaborated, and offers so few of them. I think David Walter once told a client, yeah, I can give you my own train design, or I can use an Omega. If you want to finance 2 years of engineering, we can go with an original train. Otherwise, let me use the Omega, and you can have your watch in 6 to 8 months, and that was the option. So Ludovic does do that, and again, not uncommon in really low volume watchmaking.
I think something like that shows foresight in mechanical prowess, in watchmaking prowess in general. And, you know, to touch on that kind of, all the way, you know, beginning to end foresight, something as simple as the hour indicator on the upside down hiding underneath of the, I guess in this case, the bezel on the watch in a way that truthfully you don't notice until it is the hour of which it is when you're reading the time, and the dot that indicates the hour spins around and shows the opposite color.
That's correct. The hour actually is slightly cropped by the overhang of the bezel. And there's a little dot index on each one of the rotating wheels. And when the current hour jumps upright, the dot pops out from under the bezel, and so you can see more easily. A really cool watch. I think we sold it for about $100,000, which is right about what they sell for new. So really good value retention. Nice to see a guy who is not a hype watch maker or particularly mainstream pulling down solid money, because I know you can go out there and you can find watches from the likes of Sven Anderson and early Roger Dubuis and even Daniel Roth, and they're nowhere near what you would expect a watch by that caliber of creator to actually cost, given what people pay for, you know, Dufour, Voutilainen, F.P. Journe. So this was really kind of heartening to me. Not hyped up and also not deflated, but priced just right. So I liked everything about this watch. The look, the rarity, the guy, and the fact that the market seems to have pegged it. Very happy on that front.
I do think it speaks to the fact that collectors are here for interesting timepieces, largely. And I think this is a grand statement, but I do think this is one of the more interesting timepieces that has come out or that we've seen.
Yeah, without a doubt. It's been around for a while. There's no doubt that Ludovic builds watches in long production runs. He's been building this one since 2009. There's also the Halftime, which is very cool. He's got something new coming out soon, or so he says. Really nice piece, and it's what I love about working here, that, yeah, we've got the Rolex, the Journe, the Patek, but we've also got really weird stuff, and it gets as small as a dude who makes sometimes as few as one watch a month. Now, jumping into the broader market, we've seen a lot of chronograph movement. It's the most popular complication. Let's be honest. If you don't consider a data complication, then the chronograph really is the king on the marketplace. What have you seen recently that's interested you in the chronograph space? Because I know you were talking a bit about the new Omega.
Yeah, we were discussing the new this new white dial Speedmaster in the office a little bit, which is, of course, debuted on the wrist of Daniel Craig at a recent premiere or a red carpet event of some sort. And I remember seeing the press photos on Hodinkee of that and being, you know, a little bit excited about something different for Speedmaster. You know, I talk about Speedmaster in the sense of being a classic, but I think when one looks at Speedmaster, you should look left when a lot of people are looking right and get one of the Marks, Mark II, something like that. But this kind of brings a little bit of color into the Speedy line, for lack of a better phrase. But I think it just opens up the line for a little bit more fun, honestly. The white dial seems a little bit less stark, a little bit less serious than the black dial. And I am also a sucker for an Alaska project, so I don't hate seeing the Speedmaster case with a white dial.
Yeah, I thought that the Alaska look was fantastic, but limited and polarizing because of some of the other features. This is a crowd pleaser. White lacquer, sapphire sandwich, so display case back, sapphires on both sides. Interesting watch. I'm not sure that I'm in love with it, but I like the fact that there are more options. In terms of Speedmasters, I know you mentioned the marks. The marks are a lot of fun. I would probably advise people who want unusual Speedmasters to look for things that include uncommon refinements. Like in the early 90s, when we had a small number of chronometer certified moonwatches, or in the, you know, I would say there were some Speed Sonic chronographs that were pretty cool.
Speed Sonic Lobster Bracelet,
yep,
is one of my favorites.
Speed Sonic Lobster Bracelet. I would recommend that. Highly, highly recommended. Sort of, I guess you could call it like a borderline modern electronic watch, because I think it was all tuning fork powered. But yeah, if you've checked out Chuck Maddox's website, God bless. But if you've seen Chuck Maddox's website, you know that he had a thing for cam chronograph calibers, but he also gave his due to obscurities from the 70s and 80s and the Lobster Bracelet. If you go Speed Sonic chronograph, you really have to go with the Lobster Bracelet. And I'd also say that the smaller Speedmasters too, the Schumachers are fantastic.
The reduced is a great case.
And I would also say, realistically, get the Jordan, because everyone's got the Ferrari, the red dial Speedy Reduced. And then after that, people go for the blue Benetton. But people forget that Schumacher started his career at Jordan. And I think the yellow dial Schumacher is actually the coolest of them.
The yellow looks the coolest on the strap to me. And I think it also looks the best with the bezel.
Yeah, and they're good pieces to wear. Really nicely sized. Automatic winding works better for a lot of folks. I think if you've got a significant other and you're trying to like grasp at straws to justify a watch, it always helps to have something sized so both of you can wear it. So that's definitely good. And I think if you're looking at Speedmasters, you need to consider the X33, because I've...
Good pull.
Yeah, it's the watch that, frankly, if it were launched today, it would be a smash hit. But the fact that it came out in 1998, when no one was looking for this kind of watch, and you could get a Breitling Aerospace for a lot less money, it was just the wrong time. And I think they mismarketed it.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but that watch is the source of a little bit of regret with you. Is that correct?
It really is. I had a chance to buy it for hundreds of dollars, not thousands, new with box when I was in the military. Now, the first generation of the X33 was made for the public between 1998 and 2006, but it was available to the military long after that in a military purchase program where you'd have to buy it, but then there would be some agreement that you wouldn't sell it for around 3 years, I think it was. And I realized I could get the one on the Kevlar strap in box with like the spacesuit packaging and all that for like $700. It was some ridiculously low amount of money. And I just took it for granted that, you know, I was going to have a long career in the military. I'd have plenty of opportunities. You know, $700 seems like a lot of money when you're an ensign and you're just getting started. And, you know, ultimately I got a little bit sick and it was difficult to like continue a career in public affairs unless you were an O4 already. So I decided that between deployment issues and, you know, some illnesses that were lingering and seniority problems, you know, with trying to get PAO billets, I thought, you know what, I'll just go into the private sector and see if I can be someone's press officer. And of course, by that point, I'd forgotten about the military purchase program on the Speedmaster. And by the time it came back to the forefront of my mind, I was in the watch industry writing professionally. and I just missed the boat, but it was available as late as like 2009, 2010, if you were in the military, and it was only a few $100 more to get it on the full titanium bracelet. So I really screwed up. That is my biggest non-buyer's remorse recollection of my time in watches.
Now, Omega just released a Seamaster that is for, I believe, Navy SEALs only. What is this something that they do historically?
I have never seen any evidence that Navy SEALs are relying on luxury mechanical watches. When I was in the Navy, we had this JLC, you know, master compressor diving Navy SEAL series. And I, you know, had passing encounters with SEALs, and I talked to them about watches from time to time. I never met a single person either from East Coast or West Coast SEAL teams or training facilities that claim to have one of these watches or be evaluating anything. I mean, we've seen Navy SEALs JLCs. We've seen Tudors that are associated with BUDS, you know, basic underwater demolition SEAL. We've seen the supposedly Navy SEALs themed Omega. I have never seen any evidence that it's anything more than a branding exercise. Because I remember the guys who actually were in those communities, Timex Iron Man, G-Shock, and then when they were styling like the Navy Ball, that type of thing, every fall they do the Navy Ball, then they break out the Rolex. And culturally, Rolex was a big deal with Navy SEALs. Not necessarily the thing you would wear in combat, although we do know our good friend Rob Huberty wore his Deep Sea in combat and firefights. So he was a SEAL and he was a Rolex guy, and they kind of all were. So at most, I think if they were going to wear a mechanical watch, maybe like a G-SAR or something, like a marathon G-SAR like that in combat if it was mechanical. But, you know, I think the X33 is just a great value, because if you look at where it is in the market right now, for $2,000-$3,000, you're getting something that was certified for use by NASA. It was, you know, colloquially called the Mars watch in the early days, because people thought it would be the watch that went to Mars. Everyone was getting big on Mars in the late 1990s. I don't know if it was just that people thought this was the logical next step, or if it was like the residual space fascination from Independence Day, which came out in 1996. I realize these two things should have nothing to do with each other, but the entire Scottish separatist movement got a huge shot in the arm from Braveheart. So, you know, if it sounds ridiculous that people were suddenly excited about Mars in the late 90s, that absolutely flowed from the stupid alien movie.
Well, and fast forward to when did it come out? 2021 to the modern X-33 mission to Mars.
Yeah, well, I mean, hey, it could happen. It could be private sector this time. Elon Musk wants to go to Mars. I don't see any reason to want to go to Mars. If you just imagine what life would be like. Sit in the inside of the economy seats in an airliner. Now imagine that for the rest of your life. That's life on Mars. Enjoy.
I read an article about the first, quote unquote, the first few exhibitions that would go to Mars. And this article was a few years ago, so take this with a grain of salt. But they said the lifespan of the first exhibition was 67 days.
Yeah, not exciting. So the X-33 gives you the best part of going to Mars without having to actually, you know, sit in a can for a couple of months. Yeah, it's got everything: perpetual calendar, alarm, secondary time zone, 12, 24-hour time formats, backlight. It's got an alarm, but it's also got a countdown timer. So an alarm chimes at a time of day. A countdown timer rings after a specific programmed countdown. It's got all sorts of features that are incredibly useful. It's light on the wrist. It's made of titanium.
Multiple chronos, split second.
Exactly. And you know what? People say, well, why wasn't it thermocompensated? Well, first of all, the Delta model was. It had a unique caliber, the 1666. The Delta version of that, the last one, was thermocompensated. So if you need that, sure. The idea was it would always be inside of a spacesuit or inside of a capsule. It wasn't like the Moonwatch, which could be worn externally. This was always going to be worn in a climate-controlled environment, so there was no need for thermocompensation. They could make a very fine, very precise, very capable quartz movement without ever having to, for example, account for negative temperatures or searing temperatures external to a spacesuit. So that's why it wasn't thermocompensated. But I recommend that to anyone who's looking for a truly great instrument watch. It's one of those examples of a chronograph that's more than a chronograph, whereas something like a Moonwatch or a Reduced, it's just a chronograph. you know, it's not like a complication chronograph. Exactly. Do you have any views on that? Like, if you're going to go with a chronograph that's got complications, it could be quartz or it could be mechanical. Which one comes to mind there?
I am probably in the minority of... I don't necessarily care for paired complications with chronographs unless it is a calendar. I don't necessarily need a date. I don't want a date. Personally, again, but I really like, for example, the 5960, an annual calendar paired with a chronograph. Of course, the 5270, a perpetual chrono, something like that. Those are the complications I like paired with a chronograph. But if we're talking strictly chronographs, I like standard time. I like a full minute totalizer and hour totalizer. So I like a three register chrono, but chronograph is the complication that I want on a watch, largely.
Yeah, now it's interesting because people do have a sort of chronograph purism. Some folks who are into their Daytonas, they're into their moon watches, they don't want to have any ancillary functions crowding the dial. And I suppose you could take like a traditional Navitimer guy and throw him into that, that group as well. Because traditionally, the Navitimers would have been no-date manual wind. And I look at the slide rule as more of an additional feature, not an additional function, because it's not related to the movement. And there were several movements used in the original manual wind 806s, and none of them had any relationship to the slide rule bezel. I'm a huge fan of the Navitimer, but I think that needs to be in that discussion. And I really do think if you're going to buy a modern Navitimer, it's great to consider something like the 2019 reference 806 1959 re-edition. Now, they made a couple of different versions. You get it in precious metal, you get it in steel. Get it in steel. That's the one to own.
Definitely. That it's a manual wind caliber. It is very true to form of the original. And, you know, it's really interesting that the granted, maybe it's because the Navitimer has had so many different versions and has had, quite honestly, a varying and relatively high starting price point for the most part compared to something like the Speedmaster, which for the longest time was a $5,000 retail watch. I'm very curious why Navitimer isn't more in the chronograph discussion. I think Breitling's brand malaise really spreads over all of the good that they have, and they do have a decent amount of good.
But why don't we talk about Omega and Breitling in the same breath? Because I really do think Omega is closer to Breitling in brand stature and image than it is to Rolex. But still, I think Breitling left itself with so much work to do when the new management came on in 2017 that we're still talking about the Longines and the Tags of the world. And I think that's a difficult comparison if you're Breitling.
So I think you nailed it, actually, with the comparison to Longines and Tag. And I think, and I'm curious on your opinion on this, I think when Tudor and Breitling started collaborating a little bit more, that kind of shifted in a way. And I could be wrong about that. I could be wrong about the time period. But I remember there being a decent amount of buzz surrounding the, you know, Tudor-Breitling movement. I believe they even hired watchmakers from Rolex who constructed the 4130 movement.
Yeah, the thing is, you do talk. That's another, along with Tag Heuer and Longines, and, you know, Tudor and Oris, those are the watches you talk about when you talk about Breitling. And I think it's a little bit unfortunate because Tudor actually uses Breitling's chronograph caliber. And when I think of Breitling, I think of a brand that's defined by chronographs. I will say this about the Navitimer. I like it a lot. And I think that you can find a version you like. I would say the 1959 is almost like a core model. But unlike Rolex, where, you know, a steel Daytona is the core Daytona, and Omega, where the Moonwatch is the core Speedmaster, or I think it's more like JLC, where there are just so many reversos, there is no core reverso. Even though it's, quote, the icon, you could picture 1,000 different watches in your head that are all reversos, and very few are more definitive than others. And that's the problem the Navitimer has. There's no regular production equivalent of like a Royal Oak Jumbo, where you can always buy the direct descendant.
That's the one. That is a Navitimer. Yeah, that's a really solid point.
And I like the Navitimer's calculator, but a lot of people are put off by it. This is another reason why I think it's such a controversial watch, because people don't know what the scale means or how to use it. So you wind up with a relatively shrunken dial, regardless of the size of the watch. And there have been some monsters. We've seen 44, 45, 46 millimeter Navitimers. We've seen 48s and 49s. And once you get to that size, you get pigeonholed as like a brand of the 2000s, which Breitling certainly was.
I feel like the Navitimer is especially bad at wearing a large case measurement due to the fact that it's all dial and crystal.
Yeah, I think the biggest problem with Breitling is that they've got an icon that's really esoteric. And if you look at their actual sales, their best-selling model line is Super Ocean Heritage. And before that, it was Chronomat.
Lifestyle watch.
Yeah, there's never been a time in the modern era since the Schneider family resumed production in 1983. There has not been a time when the Navitimer was consistently the lead seller in the line. Whereas if you look at the likes of Omega and Rolex, the Daytonas and the Moonwatches are among the most demanded models, if not the most demanded.
The most talked about also.
So now, moving away from like a purist's chronograph, where it's a chronograph for its own sake, you mentioned the Patek 5960, which is a flyback chrono, a power reserve, and an annual calendar, so there's a lot going on there. When I think about complicated chronographs, I usually do jump straight to the perpetual calendar genre. The one that I really like, because value is outstanding, is the Vacheron Constantin Malt Perpetual Calendar Chronograph.
I love the malt cases in general.
I believe that's the 47112. And so I want to say it's the 47112. It's a 39. It's a Hunter case back. It was made in platinum. It was made in yellow gold. And it's a rare instance of a watch that I'd actually prefer in yellow gold because it's not very big. And I think a small watch in yellow gold is in good taste. Once you get to Hublot sizes, yellow gold goes off the rails. Or if there's a full bracelet, yellow gold goes off the rails. But when you're talking about a 39 with malt lugs and a very antiquarian aesthetic and sensibility, it feels like something Vacheron could have made in the 50s or 60s. That's a really nice watch. And if you're a film buff, you know Michael Mann's probably one of the foremost Vacheron collectors and enthusiasts in the world of celebrity. And so you'll see Vacheron watches in his movies and shows. And so if you saw the Miami Vice movie, then this was Crockett's watch. In the show, it was an Abel 1911, but in the movie, it was this Vacheron.
This watch is amazing. It is effectively a 5270 at a literal fraction of the price.
Yeah, not just a 5270 at a fraction of the price, but it's non-duplicative of what else is on the market. It doesn't look like any AP. It doesn't look like any Patek. It's got a really nice case with the Hunter back, and if, like me, you have mixed feelings about the obsession with sapphire case backs, there's something reassuring about getting all the value and integrity of a full gold back plus the sapphire rather than having to choose.
The heft of the full metal case back is amazing. I think I'm in the minority in really preferring a solid case back, actually. I understand what's going on under the hood. I understand why it's interesting, and I understand why people like it, but I've seen a lot, and I really like a solid case back, you know, and a Hunter case back is the best of both worlds. You know, I'm just scrolling through photos of the Malt Perpetual, and the lugs, these are soldered and welded on, assuming.
Oh,
yeah, are amazing. There's something about the deco shape of the case lugs on every malt that is outrageous. Honestly, the case flank of the 9 o'clock flank of this watch is more interesting than entire cases of some other watches.
And you mentioned that it is like getting a Patek Philippe perpetual calendar chrono for like a fifth of the price. If you recall, this was a Lamagna base. And so you've got what is effectively
5970.
Exactly. It's 3970 and 5970. That is the movement in here. It is an incredible watch. It is in great taste. And it's one of the few Vacheron designs from the 2000s and the 2010s that has really stood the test of time and looks Vacheron. I've always said that Vacheron struggles, with the possible exception of the 1921 American, they don't really have a design icon the way, you know, other high-end brands do. I've always found their outstanding long-term aesthetic tradition is elaborate lugs, everything from the malts to the historic Corne de Vache.
You know, I was just about to point out the lugs on this. It's almost as if, so my exact thought process was the Patrimony collection of Vacheron's modern collection of Patrimony is evocative of this case. If you took away the case, the flanks on the lugs. If you made the case less deco, you know, the lugs are straight, whereas if you can see the main lugs on this case, they are straight, but you have the extra stepping that reaches out, and it's an asymmetrical extra stepping that's really makes the case interesting. But it seems like the modern Patrimonies are on the more vanilla end of case design.
Yeah, I would agree with that. The problem the Echeron has is that it has Patrimony and Traditionnel, and neither one of them has a really strong, instantly recognizable design language. And the Malt collection, which spawned this wonderful watch and many others, unfortunately, I want to say it was in the late 2000s, but it became an all Tunno collection. And a lot of folks find Tunno's hard to wear. It's a little bit of a frumpy style. It's a super niche. Culling the regular lugs from the Malt, really kneecapped, was probably Vacheron's most compelling full-line dress watch collection. Because I love the 1921, but it can only ever look like a 1921. You can do things with the dial. You can change the size and the case metal, but it's always going to look the same. Whereas in the Malt collection, you could have wildly different watches as long as the lug design codes were respected. And I just thought there was more variety there in the beginning of something really exciting. And, you know, Vacheron has incredible capability, but they shoot themselves in the foot having too many watches, too many model lines, and not enough distinction among the models. So yeah, that's sort of how I feel with chronographs. I like a calendar. And, you know, sometimes this is going to be like the JLC Master Chrono Calendar, which is just a simple calendar with a chronograph and an automatic movement, or it could be something like a perpetual calendar with the Vacheron, or an annual calendar with the Patek Philippe. There's a lot of really great options out there, but for the most part, when you add complications to a chronograph, it's going to be a perpetual calendar. Now, every once in a while, you do see a split second at the highest level. And that's where I think things get really interesting, because unless you're going with some sort of 7750-based split, and there's a million of them out there, a million, like, thank you, Richard Hoppering. You know, you start talking about stuff like the Patek Philippe, you know, 5370, or this crazy Parmigiani that crossed my desk the other day.
The white gold on a bracelet with the salmon dial.
It was even crazier. It was full platinum.
Oh, that's right. It is platinum. Yes.
a five-piece limited edition. Now, you might have seen Parmigiani's Tanda PF line. These debuted as the Tanda GT back in 2020, and it's really helped Parmigiani to increase its volume and its viability to the point where you're now hearing stories that Guido Tereni, who's been CEO for the last couple of years, might be helping the Sandoz Family Foundation, which owns Parmigiani, to shop it on the market. And previously, this company would not have been an appealing purchase just because it never made money. And that's, you know, kind of what you can do when you're endowed by a pharmaceutical empire. But now, thanks to the Tanda PFs, these sports watches have made Parmigiani a moneymaker. And I think I can confidently say this watch I saw is not one of those. There were five of these. They were platinum. The standard version of this watch, the PF Split Second Chrono, came out in 2021. This one was a 2023 of five pieces, 42 millimeters. It had a salmon dial, like you said, but it was only salmon colored. It was made of media blasted platinum. And, you know, if you're out in cyberspace and you're listening to this, you know, open up Watchbox Reviews, which is my YouTube channel, and you can find this watch, and you can actually view it at your leisure, but most importantly, see what I'm talking about. It's a split-second chrono, and again, pulsometric scale, salmon dial made of platinum, 100 meters water resistant. It has the lovely Tanda teardrop lugs. It has a coined bezel. It has a full integrated matching platinum bracelet. It had a mass of about 300 grams, you know, close to 3/4 of a pound. Very impressive stuff. But the movement came from the Parmigiani Tanda Chronor Anniversaire from 2016. And it's the PF361, which is 18 karat gold, bridges and plates. So think FP
Journe. It's gorgeous. I'm looking at it now.
Now, we talk about interior angles where two bevels meet in a sharp crease, and how, you know, some Geneva Hallmark movements have one or none of these. Well, this watch, I was approaching 50 when I stopped counting. And it's got a 65-hour reserve, a 10-beat-per-second El Primero-style beat rate, twin black-polished steel column wheels, split-second, vertical clutch, just an unbelievable machine.
Open bridges. It's gorgeous to look at.
The bridges are skeletonized and solid gold and interior beveled and drawn out with incredible sharp interior creases. So you owe it to yourselves to check this out, because if you want to know what Parmigiani is capable of, you need to say that Parmigiani, when it wants to, is fully capable of matching the likes of Ferdinand Berthoud, Grubel Forsey, Debatoun, Lang und Heine, and a lot of boutique independents I rate highly, like Voutelainen or Recep Recepi or Aaron Beche of Hungary. I mean, really, Parmigiani needs to be mentioned in that kind of company based on watches like this. But this is what I mean when I say most splits that are not at least distantly based on a 7750 are really high-end watches.
Whenever I hear high-end split, the 5959 comes first to mind. It's a Patek's first in-house chronograph. It's a 33-millimeter split-second chronograph that is the stuff of dreams, honestly. And, you know, admittedly, when we first started talking about this, when I think chrono, I think standard three-register chrono is the first thought. But I think split-second is one of the more special complications that does exist.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, the splits, and Alango Unzona has taken this to the logical extreme by splitting seconds, minutes, and hours with the triple split. By the way, guys, if you're out there and you've got the wrist for it, 43.2 millimeters precious metal, consider a double split, a breakthrough watch, a first of its kind when it came out in 2004. If you're looking for a place to put money where it's safe, not necessarily something that's going to make you rich like Magnificent 7 S&P stocks or NASDAQ growth prospects, I'm saying if you want something that is basically a long-term bet, the way early Roger Dubuis was a really smart long-term bet back in 2015, 2014, go out and get yourself a platinum double split, because its greatness and its historic importance is acknowledged, but not, it's acknowledged by collectors and historians, but not yet recognized by the market. So consider that. But Lange did take it the next step with the triple split. And I want to say the triple split first came out, I want to say 2018, because I remember I saw it at SIHH, and, you know, initially it was white gold. There's been a rose gold version with a blue dial, but you can split the seconds, the minutes, and the hours. And that's why I say, in general, unless you're talking about some sort of 7750-based split, they're almost always high horology pieces and very high. You mentioned the 5959. Just quickly let our audience know what that is. That's a very unusual watch.
The 5959 is the Patek's first in-house chronograph. It was a 33-millimeter, released in 2001?
A little bit later than that, 2005.
But okay.
Yeah, you're in the ballpark, though, that early to mid-2000s era. And I think I would class the 5959 as sort of the child of the datograph, and here's why. Because right up until the datograph arrived at Basel in 1999, it was considered perfectly appropriate for ultra haute de gamme Swiss brands to use a Bausch on chronographs. And when Lange showed up with caliber L951, the acceptable luxury of Bausch was all but done for, at least at Patek. That's where they started moving towards their own in-house calibers. And the movement in the 5959 was the first constitution of their in-house chronograph architecture. And like Armand mentioned, it was a very antiquarian thing. 33 millimeters, extremely compact. I believe officer's case design, not to everyone's liking. It was designed to be a very classical size and shape and design to set this watch apart. It couldn't look like any other chronograph Patek was making. And they also wanted to appeal only to the purest collector, not necessarily flippers. So they made it a officer's case in a very tiny format. But that was the beginning, and a really special piece and a split, and exceptionally rare. They don't come up often.
It's very doctor's watch adjacent to me. And it's one of those rare watches that I've never seen in the metal. There are, you know, you have fewer that you've never seen in the metal than I, but there, you know, I've never seen that piece, and it's one that's really on my radar to look at.
I've seen it, but only rarely. It's an uncommon piece to see anywhere outside of, you know, a collector's corner at Dubai Watch Week. Like if you go to a place where a lot of super high-end guys congregate, that's like where you'll see a 5959. you know, an event at Dubai, an event in Hong Kong, an event in Singapore, that's where you'll see that kind of watch.
And the beauty with a watch like that is, to borrow a phrase from Brian, actually, that is a watch that makes me wonder what other Pateks the wearer has.
Yeah, really. You know, a lot of times the other Pateks the guy has are all application pieces. So, I mean, the sky is the limit at that point. You could have something like a 5275 in there, the jump hour, jump second, jump minute with chiming. You could have, I mean, that's like the kind of watch a Claude Sapphire would wear, or like a Laurent Picciotto, like a really super and high-end guy who's famous for being famous in the watch industry, like that sort of thing. But yeah, splits. Now, if you want one that's actually sort of high horology, but not a Richard Habering style, cut and spliced 7750 split, look into the Omega Deville Chronoscope from 2005. A really cool mid-2000s application of a Blancpain Frederic Piguet base. So it's based on a 1285, which is Frederic Piguet's somewhat larger and more durable version of the 1185 that has been used by Breguet, Blancpain, Audemars Piguet, Vacheron. This version, I want to say it's like the 1286, became a Omega caliber and a display case back, twin column wheels, visually very impressive coaxial adaptation of the Frederic Piguet base. It's five position adjusted. It's chronometer certified. It is not a 7750 based split. It's a real high horology automatic that, as far as I've seen, was never featured on any watch made outside of the Swatch group. So unlike, say, the 7750 splits developed by both ETA and La Jouperet and Habering and IWC, this is an example of something that's more or less exclusive to Omegas. And you'll see versions of the same split architecture in Blancpain, but you're not going to see them all over the industry. This is a really cool way of paying Omega prices with a steel case and getting something that's really on the same level as an Audemars Piguet, a Blancpain, a Vacheron, or a Breguet. A really, really cool piece and a connoisseur's choice. Stepped lugs, a Gaudron-style bezel, overlapping almost like Seyfert scale dial. Not everyone likes the look, but I do like the look. So for me, this is just a great buy and a cool way to go high horology while sticking with Omega. And 100 meters water resistant.
You know, there's something about the case that's really outrageous. There's something about the date that's really offensive. The,
Yeah, because it was the beginning of triple dates where you can see three
numbers.
Yeah.
Yes, the shape of that date window is really outrageous. But I have to give Omega props to this in the sense that they put a chapter ring around it. They rimmed their date window with, it looks like some sort of blued steel potentially, but it's a nice touch. You know, again, I don't like where it is. I don't like the shape at all. I do not like the triple date, but gosh, they went the extra mile and they put the ring around the hole that they put in the dial.
Yeah, this is one of those cases where I will admit that you love it or you hate it. And if you hate it, you're going to immediately say that that dial is a dog's breakfast. And you're not wrong. You're not wrong. Another really cool application of a split that you hardly ever see, and guys, if you find one, buy it on site. But back in 2010, Zenith launched a split-second chronometer with a big date, and this was the El Primero split-second, unbelievable big-date chronometer with split-second capability, El Primero movement, and just a watch that, for me, represented such a return to form after the traumatic years of Terrain Atoff design. This is a watch that looks like a Zenith. It looks like a bigger version of something Zenith could have made during its chaste and universally appealing style phase of the late 80s and early 90s. This will look beautiful next to your rainbow flyback in your Zenith case. And because it's El Primero based, it's everything that an El Primero is, plus you've got the big date, plus you've got the chronometer certification. And non-Rolex El Primeros with a chronometer cert are really rare. You can swim with this thing. It looks fantastic. The dial is balanced. It was expensive. It was a flagship. And it was part of that, you know, Jean-Frédéric Dufour revitalization of the brand, almost like the cold water after the excess of Nataf. And Jean-Frédéric Dufour rode the success of designs like this all the way to the top seat at Rolex. So you can really see historically that it was relevant to more than just Zenith.
I feel the same way about El Primero that I do about Speedmaster. If you're going to get an El Primero, absolutely add one to the collection. Get an interesting one. And this is a really, really interesting one. You know, you have, granted, it's a little bit large at 44, but it is very much an El Primero case. It is very much an El Primero dial. And despite the fact that it's a split movement, you have the heart and soul of El Primero, which is, honestly, it's cooler this way.
Yeah, this is a watch that is large. There's no doubt about that, but it's purposefully large. You don't get the sense that it's, you know, Hublot oceanographic 5,000 meter large, which is just large for large's sake. A really nice piece, but the proportions of it are perfect. And because of the way the dial's laid out with concentric tracks, you don't notice the disparity between case size and movement size. And eventually I'm going to get around to talking about Patek 5070 just because I love it so much and I can't go a full chrono episode without mentioning it.
It's one of my favorite chronos.
But as we wind our way through the different kinds of chronos that you guys should be looking for actively, I'm going to say that there's a very small but hugely useful class of chronographs with alarms built in. And Zenith probably made the best one in the Pilot Doublematic. Now, there was an unwearably huge and bizarre Terry Nataf version of this. It was called the Multi-City Traveler. But I'm specifically speaking of the Pilot Doublematic that came out in 2012, where you have an alarm power reserve, an on-off function for the alarm, an El Primero chronograph, and a world time function. All of these in one watch. It is a really cool piece and a huge value in the space.
And that piece in steel retailed originally for, I think, $12,000 and change, which is absolutely outrageous for the level of complication that you get. I think there was a rose gold version that retailed in the low 20s as well, which is even more outrageous for a precious metal timepiece. The Doublematic is really interesting because, like you said, it, despite the fact, again, that it is a larger size timepiece, it is remarkably wearable. You can wear that watch. I can wear that watch. It doesn't look like we're wearing our father's watches.
No, it doesn't at all. And frankly, when you're wearing it, you just kind of find yourself overcome by a sense that the size is warranted by all of those functions. How else are you going to fix all of these things inside one case? You know, it's not big for big's sake. It's big because this was the smallest case that could corral all of that functionality.
The power reserve for the alarm on that watch is probably, I can say this in confidence, it's my favorite power reserve for an alarm on a watch because it's so animated. As the alarm is going off, you can watch the power reserve spin counterclockwise and clock down and change color from green to red as it goes down. It's amazing. It animates the dial and it takes something that honestly you didn't need to have. It adds it and it makes it fun.
And I'll also say that it's an affordable watch today. You should be able to bargain one of these down to 10 grand. Find it used. There's not a ton of them on the market, but they're out there. Bargain it down to 10 and just imagine what it would cost if Richard Mille made a watch that had all of these functions. I don't think $10,000 would be the tax on the purchase.
I think you would be paying $10,000 for a strap for that watch.
You would pay through the nose, honestly. It'd be one of those things where the only discount you're getting is they give you some stupid cufflink and try to make you feel like, you know, they're doing you a favor. It would be one of those APRP built Richard Mille watches. It would be deep into six figures, maybe seven. It would have the name of an F1 driver on it, and you would only be able to buy it at a booze fueled party on the top of a Dubai skyscraper. So just consider yourself lucky that you can go out and get a Doublematic on Chrono 24. And then I think I'm just going to mention one more Zenith from like the early 2010s because there's nothing else like it, the Retro Timer. Guys, something like 1,000 of these were made, the vast majority of which were on a strap. If you can find a silver dial Retro Timer on a full bracelet, don't even bargain, just buy it. Zenith confirmed that number to me, that it was around 1,000. It was an unusual flyback chrono that was full-time engaged. So it's unlike any El Primero before or since. It's 42 millimeters. It's a good size. It's 100 meters. You can swim with it. A really compelling watch that is just as unique as it is collectible. There are some watches that are highly collectible, but not unique. This is collectible and unique. So kind of moving on from that, we talked about chronographs with alarms. Don't forget that Fortis has built a whole succession since 1998 of Paul Gerber designed mechanisms that give you both a chronograph and an alarm in one package. And those use cost even less than the Double-Matic. So Armand, let's head back into the world of Patek. How do you feel about the 5070s?
The 5070 for a large watch, but coming in at 42 millimeters, is for some reason has struck a chord with me so fiercely for as long as I can remember that every time I see one, I can't help but put it on the wrist. The yellow gold is my favorite version. It's a perfect aesthetic to me. It's yellow gold, black dial. It's an amazing bicompact. It has a grand, massive scale on the dial. Now, that is to make up for the disparity in size of movement to case. And for some reason on this watch, it does not bother me at all.
It's so perfect, and it's such a successful execution that you can't really quibble with it. I think that your objection to a 5070 is going to be to the size alone. Some people don't think a dress chronograph should be that big. And when it came out in 1998 at 42 millimeters, I mean, it was revolutionary back then. The only high-end watches that were that big back then were, you know, Royal Oak Offshore, Portuguese, or Panerai Luminor. This was the successor to the 1463, which is a dinky little thing that went out of production around 1970.
It's still remarkable to me that the 5070 has such pricing disparity between the three metals and the elephant in the room of platinum. You know, you can get a rose gold, white gold, or yellow gold piece, all now, I guess, probably within the, call it, high 60s to low 80s, give or take, depending on condition, depending on completeness of sets, and depending on level of refinish or service history. However, the platinum is not touchable under $190,000 at absolute minimum, probably naked.
Yeah, there's about 1,000 in yellow, 1,000 in rose, 1,000 in white, not counting special editions. But the platinum was this 1 year run and
300,
it,
right?
Yeah, it, at most, I would say maybe even closer to 200, because the idea was about 250 per metal per year until they got to the platinum. And then I think it's less than that. If you do want the king of 5070s, though, it is actually white gold. It is the Saatchi Gallery limited edition, believed to be about 5 white gold case. And a salmon dial. And of course, every time Patek does a grand exhibition, there's a theme to the collection. And the theme at the Saatchi Gallery was unique reissues of discontinued references. And this was the best of the 5070s.
I was just about to say, the Saatchi Gallery has quite a few really good limited editions.
Yeah, absolutely stunning stuff. And so I think that this, made in probably 5 pieces, is the ultimate 5070. But for me, I love the look of the yellow gold with the black dial. First, because it's true to history. The inspiration for the 5070 is not its predecessor watch, the 1463. It is the piece unique 2512 chronograph that's in the Patek Museum.
The split second post-war.
Yes.
Yes, 46 millimeter. That reference is outrageous. When we went to the 2017 Grand Exhibition, I spent like 10 minutes in front of that case. It's an amazing timepiece.
There's another 2512 that's not a chrono, but it's the chrono that inspired the 5070. And there's something about the contrast between the black dial and the yellow gold case that makes this one a lot more intense than, you know, the sort of silver gray dials of the white gold and the rose gold, which are nice, but I wouldn't describe them as arresting. Whereas the combination of the black dial with the yellow gold is definitely arresting. And I think that's part of what made the platinum watch so desirable. Dark dials and a light case. And I don't like yellow gold. I think 42 yellow gold is too big unless it's this. I'm not sure why I'm just given to this watch, but this is one of the only yellow gold modern watches I would wear. If I were to buy a 5070, this is the one I would seek.
Likewise.
Unpolished, full set, put it on the wrist and be done with it. You never need another chronograph for as long as you live.
It's amazing. I absolutely am a yellow gold guy. I'm Italian. I feel like I have to be a yellow gold guy. And, you know, white gold looks okay on my skin tone. Yellow gold looks amazing. And I understand what you mean. You know, you mentioned earlier about a yellow gold bracelet being a little ostentatious. But I think with this watch, there's so much gold. It's also all of these now have a little bit of time behind them, right? So this type of yellow gold is going to show a touch of patina in the sense of starting to look a little darker than that of modern production yellow gold. And I think that really tones down yellow in a way. Old gold, as we like to call it, vintage gold feels much better than modern gold.
There is something about yellow gold. And you got to remember, all jewelry grade gold is an alloy. So 18 karat is 75% gold. It's those other things that create, you know, the tarnish. There's this phrase, bas coriale. It's a type of tarnish that forms on gold over time, named after a stash, I want to say, of gold Roman coins found at the bottom of a well. And I think bas coriale was where this was. And they had this incredible tarnish, almost like they'd been heat tempered over time. And that can form on a gold watch that's been sitting for decades. So if you find a 5070 with that coating on it, and just formed by natural elements and time combined, do not refinish it, because that is bitchin' awesome. Oh my God. Look it up. Keep us streaming. But the Bas Coriale tarnish on gold, just Google that. You'll see exactly what I mean. I've seen some 5070 J's that look like that. Very, very rare, because it requires the owner to basically buy it and then put it away for at least two decades before you start to see that. It's the same thing with sterling silver. People wonder why it tarnishes. It's not because it's silver. That won't tarnish. It's because it's got 6% copper in it. It's the secondary ingredients in 18 karat that are responsible for gold tarnishing. So that's sort of how that goes. Now, in terms of other chronographs, remember we talked early on about how small makers often adopt basically drivetrains to create their own watches. So sure, they won't necessarily use parts or start with an Ebauch, but they'll start with a geometry. Well, that's one of the reasons it's so uncommon to see independent brands with manual wind chronographs entirely of their own design. So I would highly recommend, if you want to see the most beautiful chronograph you can buy today, check out Long Untina, check out the Albert. I would get myself a black sterling silver dial, white gold Albert, and if I can't get that unpolished new old stock full set 5070J, this is what I would get. Long Untina, Albert, the most beautiful chronograph you can buy today, bar none. No one even stands a chance. There is no rival. There is no comparison. It's this and everything else playing for second place.
Bold words, and I love it. I'm looking at the movement now, and I don't have a counter.
And again, the fact is, like, there are some great independents out there. You know, there's Grunefeld with the Grunograph, a good example of, you know, a very small independent launching its own chronograph.
This has a diamond-capped balance.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's amazing.
There's figurative.
This is drool worthy.
Yeah, this isn't the gold standard. It's the diamond standard, both figuratively and literally. Guys, again, keep us streaming. Open a new window. Check out the ratchet wheel atop the barrel on this Long Untina. Check out the clutch.
The engraving on the balance cock, it's outrageous.
All the characters that are written on the bridges and plates are hand engraved. You get one pass at that.
Tim, the length of the teeth on the gears, mm-hmm, the shape of it's artful. I admittedly, this is, I know of Lang & Hein, and this is new to me.
This is something you guys need to look into if you want the absolute best chronograph in the world. Now, you know, is it conceivable that you could get Carrie Vuitelainen to make you a Masterpiece 2 or a Masterpiece 3? Sure. Could you get on the list for the Grunograph? Probably. But again, at least as I see it, there's this and then there's everything else. So if you've got the wrist for it and, you know, you're not a Swiss or nothing diehard, this is the way to go. Folks from Dresden have got it down. So yeah, Armand, now we've got an audience out there. All of you listening to our debut episode, thank you so much. We deeply appreciate you. Again, you want to reach out to podcasts@the1916company.com. If you got questions, we've got answers. We would love this to be an interactive experience. Armand, where can they find you online?
You can find me on Instagram at It's Me Armand, or you can send me an email at armand@thewatchbox.com. Those are my spots.
All right. Time out, Tim out, Armand out, and thank you for logging on. This has been the 1916 Company Podcast, Episode 1.